and we're back with our ethics professors. What do you do when your boss tells you to do one thing, but your heart, your mind tells you not to do that thing? I don't mean that you're told to increase your productivity or to stop playing words with friends on company time. I'm talking about real crises of conscience where your moral beliefs compel you not to, say, perform that medical procedure or sell that product or teach that lesson. Where should the customer's or the patient's wishes or needs outweigh your own? And although history is full of cases where doing the right thing has come with a cost, should it really cost you your job? Today, our ethics professors are here with us to help think this through. Wayne Vaught is Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences here at UMKC and also Professor of Philosophy, Medicine, and Bioethics. Wayne, welcome back.
Thanks for having us again.
And Clancy Martin is Professor and Chair of the Philosophy Department here at UMKC. Welcome to you, Clancy.
Thanks so much, Brian.
So, Wayne, set this up for us. The news that that causes us to be thinking about this question is that, last week, Governor Sam Brownback signs into law the Healthcare Rights of Conscience Act that prevents pharmacists or physicians from being required to offer certain kind of drugs that, might prevent or terminate a pregnancy, depending on your understanding of how those drugs work. But critics say that the law could actually result in certain women, certain patients not being able to have access to, legally available medical treatment. So what are the ethical issues at stake?
Well, I think what's fundamentally at issue is, the claim of conscience. And this is actually the issues, or go back to about a decade. There was a in 2002, there was a case of a pharmacist up in Wisconsin who had refused to dispense contraceptives to a woman who had a legitimate prescription, refused to release the prescription, refused to dispense the drugs on the grounds that he had religious objections to the use of contraceptives. In fact, had asked her, "Why are you? What's this prescription for?" When she said it was for birth control, he refused to dispense it. That really set off a stream of conscience clause debates around the issue of pharmaceuticals. And so you had a number of states, and it's actually been quite varied from state to state. In Missouri, back a few years ago, there were actually bills both for and against requiring pharmacists to dispense contraceptives in the state of Missouri. So now what we have in Kansas is governor signing into law basically an act that allows a pharmacist, and as I understand the wording of that, who reasonably believes that the pharmaceutical will terminate a pregnancy to refuse to dispense that drug. And so they're saying it's targeting RU486, which is an abortive drug. It's designed to induce abortions of an established pregnancy. The concerns are, one of the concerns would be is that, well, does this go to contraceptive drugs as well? Plan B contraceptives, which are really just a high dosage of contraceptives that a woman might regularly receive if she's on birth control. But it prevents a pregnancy from occurring. It's not known to terminate an existing pregnancy. And so this gets into the issue of the abortion rights, reproductive rights services, and the extent to which one individual who's a member of a healthcare team or a member of the health professions to be able to exercise his or her right of conscience and impose that on someone else. And it raises the interesting issues of, well, what are the consumer's rights, the patient's rights to get access to this particular drug? What are the employer's rights, the employer, the company, the pharmacy, the owner of the pharmacy has a product to which he wants or she wants to get to a customer. And in between this, you have the person, the pharmacist, who's legally authorized to dispense that drug, who now says, "I don't want to do that." Who has a right? Does the customer have a right to demand it? Does the employer have a right to say, "No, if you're going to work for me, you have to dispense this contraceptive because that's part of my business"?
And these are questions, of course, that could apply to any number of professions and any number of issues.
Oh, absolutely. It can go through the various health professions. You can look at it in terms of the abortion issue more generally. You can look at it in terms of reproductive health care services. There have been issues where this has arisen, certainly in physicians who have refused to provide a reproductive health care services for women. A couple years ago, there was in Louisiana, there was a judge, actually it was a justice of the peace, who refused to perform an interracial marriage. A couple came to his office. Actually, I don't think they came to the office. I think it was a phone call, and his wife, who was working as his assistant, was screening the call. ask the question, is this an interracial couple? The woman answered that it was, and she said, I'm sorry, we don't perform interracial marriages here. Because I conscientiously, the justice objected to that, and then a referral was made to some other justice who could handle the case. It caused a lot of public uproar because here you have, it's not the issue of abortion, but it's the issue of race, and but it's still grounded on claims of conscience. And how far do we allow someone to exert a claim of conscience, especially as it begins to impose on someone else?
Well, right. So Clancy Martin, you know, conscience, this is this word that is generally a positive word. Having a strong conscience is regarded as a healthy thing, right?
Sure, that's right. I mean, in the philosophical tradition, thinking about what's right and wrong, thinking about ethics, one of the appeals that is made really throughout Western thinking on ethics, at least since the beginning of the Christian tradition and also in the Judaic tradition, we have this idea that somehow, presumably, at the roots of its tradition, through an individual having a kind of access to of some sort to what God believes is right or wrong, that there's something inside us that tells us, look, there's certain things we should do and certain things we shouldn't do. And when we don't listen to that voice, which has come to be called by the name of conscience, and, you know, you might think of the Disney cartoons where you have the little devil sitting on one shoulder and the little angel sitting on the other, and the little angel is supposed to be the voice of conscience, and the little devil is usually the voice of human nature or something like that, the voice of temptation. That when we listen to our conscience, we are doing what is appropriate, and when we fail to listen to our conscience, that's when we're doing what we ought not be doing. And we all, of course, have had that feeling in our ordinary lives, like I didn't listen to my conscience and I did the wrong thing. And the great German poet Rainer Maria Rilke once said, whenever you're trying to decide what the right thing to do is, just do whatever is most difficult. And what he meant by that, I think, is just that, you know, in general, these conscience claims put us in really tough situations. And to have what we call moral integrity is to stand by one's conscience even when it's difficult to do so. Now, that's part of what makes this the pharmacy debate interesting. When this question was first called to my attention by Wayne's work on the subject of conscience, and he pointed out to me something I hadn't really thought about before, which is there is nothing to prevent a pharmacist from saying, I will not prescribe this drug on the basis of conscience, except the fact that in some states the pharmacist could lose her or his job over that. Well, now that's what we call standing up for one's conscience. You know, I believe this so strongly that I am willing to sacrifice my own job if necessary. But once you make it so that we are able to impose our conscience on others at no price, at no personal price, then it starts looking a little bit less like the voice of conscience and a little bit more like a kind of granting someone the ability to just simply impose their view of the world, their moral view of the world on others.
It stops being something courageous and it becomes really just a matter of their choice and maybe even an exercise of their power.
Exactly.
Yeah. We want to invite our listeners to join this conversation. Tell us what you think about pharmacists having the right to not fill a prescription that they find morally objectionable, or a doctor to perform or not perform certain procedures. Do you think that sometimes is okay? Where do you draw the line and how or why? Call us at 816-235-2888. You can also join a discussion already taking place on our Facebook page. That's KCUR's Facebook page. Or email us at updatedate@kcur.org. 816-235-2888 is the number. Wayne, is that really the real rub here? Where are the limits on these questions? Because everyone agrees that you know, a doctor doesn't have to perform certain procedures they would find objectionable, right?
Well, generally, I think that's true, though there are areas in which this is extremely complicated and gray. And this – the issue of conscience and the right of conscience and exercising one's conscience, as Clancy's pointed out, I mean, we could come up with a lot of moral exemplars, people who have been heralded for their acts of conscience and standing up for what they believed in. And I think most of us would say that's an example of what it is to have true moral character and that you should, in fact, do those types of things. But the real difficulty becomes in the nitty-gritty is that people can have really strong, deeply held convictions about some type of thing that most of society or many might find deeply offensive or problematic. And so this is where the issue really becomes a grave challenge, because on the one hand, I think we do have a moral obligation to allow people to express their values and beliefs. Immanuel Kant, I think, would certainly stake a claim like this, is that if he were to say, look, the pharmacist can't think about his or her values, must simply dispense the drugs. Kant, one of the fundamental claims in a Kantian theory of morality was that you're not to treat people as ends in and of themselves. I mean, as a means to an end, but as an end in and of themselves. Mm-hmm. And to simply say that, well, you can't think about what you're doing, you simply have to do X, Y, and Z, it would be simply to treat the pharmacist as a means to a particular end. And it would seem to potentially be in violation of that moral imperative.
That they just need to do their job.
Right. Yeah, that they're just technicians and that there are really no, you know, there's no place for their moral decision making to come into play in that. And I think most of us would find that deeply offensive, that we would say to someone, look, you're not allowed to exercise your religious beliefs, your moral convictions, wherever you're getting these convictions from.
So there isn't a certain sort of ethical, an admirable quality in doing one's job even when it challenges your own beliefs or your own preferences.
Right. Well, I think in the case with health professionals in particular, but professionals more generally, is that what's being questioned is, okay, well, you're going to have to come up with a defense. I mean, if you're at home and you have particular convictions and you think drinking's wrong, dancing's wrong, whatever it might be because of a particular religious tradition, that's fine. Once you get into a professional setting, not only do you have your own moral beliefs at play, but there are also professional practice standards and so professional ethics and codes of ethics and what physicians and health professionals and various other professionals are supposed to do. Broadcasters have broadcasting ethics. There are codes of conduct. And so one has to think of myself, not only am I a moral agent individually, but by entering into this profession, I become part of an organization that has its own code of ethics. And I have to be able to act in such a way as to be stand up for my own religious or moral beliefs, but also act in a way that's consistent with the moral standards of my profession. And so that requires, I think, honest, open debate and deliberation. But if the profession feels that, though, look, as a health, especially as a pharmacist, because you are now a licensed professional. If these were over-the-counter drugs, we wouldn't have the issue. It's the fact that the state restricts access to these drugs, puts the pharmacist in the place of being the only intermediary between the patient and the drug. Then you're taking on a very special role. And if you are unable to meet the professional ethical standards or societal standards, then it might be the case that you have to say, look, this isn't a job that I can do because it violates my moral objections. And if you even think about the abortion debate, I think that none of us, you know, if there is an abortion provider and that provider wishes to provide needs a nurse to work in that setting, you wouldn't hire a nurse, and then the person says, I object to abortions. I'm not going to work here.
Because they're in the job in the first place.
Well, you took this job, which the job description was to assist with abortions, so you can't then come in and say, well, I object to abortions. You would have to find another line of work.
We have a caller who I think wants to comment on this very topic. Harry in Leawood, good morning.
Yes, thank you. I was about to say the same thing. You know, all of these jobs that you're describing have job descriptions that you should and read and know about ahead of time. And if you find after reading it that this is part of the description of the job, don't apply in the first place. So you shouldn't be working there to start with, there would be no problem of hiring or firing you if you don't apply for the job.
Clancy, is that a fair way to look at it?
I think that's exactly right. That's the point about professionalism is because a professional is serving the interests of others, one has to think about whose interests one can sincerely and properly serve before you go into that particular profession. And that's why I'm a school teacher rather than, say, a prison guard, because that my particular code of ethics makes it very easy for me to fulfill my professional duties vis-a-vis my students, whereas I bet I wouldn't be as good a prison guard as somebody else might be because of a different set of standards.
What if you got into the pharmacy business before RU486 was invented? What about when technology leads to new ethical questions that you couldn't have anticipated?
This happens a lot and more, especially, particularly in the medical business and in the computer business, where it's not only that the drugs are developed faster than our ability to kind of think morally through what their impacts are, but they even proceed faster in computer industry, for example, than the law can keep up with them.
Right.
So, and that's when one might be tempted to say, okay, now we do have to fall back on the individual's conscience. But before you'd fall back on the individual's conscience, I would argue, and this again is an argument I'm taking from a paper of Wayne's, you should first look at what the kind of moral code specified by your duties as a professional. Because that is really the role you're occupying. And to take the case of the pharmacist, well, what you've got there is a duty to care, a duty to follow the instructions of the physician, a duty to serve the patient's needs. And so it looks like those duties would trump questions of individual conscience.
It's a great comment, Harry. Thank you so much for your call. Let's talk to Steve in Overland Park. Good morning. Steve, are you still with us? Looks like Steve is not with us. So let's talk to Sean in Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning, Sean. Well, I guess we're covering all their issues. I think the key question that your comments there raised, Clancy, for me is that this issue through the ages has always been present. I mean, although the technology may change 10 years, 20 years, we may be asking different ethical questions about conscience in the workplace, but we're still going to be asking questions that are fundamentally underlying have the same issues at work, right? I mean, there are examples of this from centuries ago, right?
Right. I mean, right. You could go back. You could look at Sir Thomas More and Henry VIII. And Thomas More was a great friend of Henry VIII. Henry VIII admired him, gave him positions of prestige. He was the chancellor under Henry VIII. And I think that there was a closeness. Even at in the British Museum in London, there's the last letter that which is interesting to go read it and see it that Thomas More wrote to Henry VIII, and it was to the very end pledging his allegiance to Henry. But what Henry wanted him to do was to support the succession of the Church of England from Rome, and Thomas couldn't do that, and he ultimately lost his head because of it. But this is sort of an example of, you know, taking a stance, making a statement about what one's moral conviction is and being ready to recognize, well, that certainly took a lot of courage on Thomas More's part. And if we have similar situations today, it seems that some degree of courage has to be come into play. If one's going to take a stand against established codes, now, you know, the difficulty becomes that there are a lot of things that someone could take a stand on, and I think race relations or gay relations, all these types of issues that come up where people take very strong stands on, and you think, well, they shouldn't be punished because they're taking a stand for the right. Right, they're standing up for a conviction,
and we think conscience is a good thing.
And well, conscience is critical. I wouldn't want to go to a physician that didn't have a conscience. I don't think we'd want to go to a pharmacist that didn't have a conscience. We have an example of a pharmacist from a few years back who was, if you remember, the story of the pharmacist who was diluting cancer therapeutic drugs to his patients.
Right.
Made tens of thousands of dollars off of hundreds of thousands of dollars off of his patients. You would say, well, that seems to be a gross lack of conscience. We want people, we need people in positions of power to have a conscience and to act on their conscience. But sometimes that comes into conflict, and well-reasoned people have to be able to debate these issues. And I don't think that you can just use conscience as a trump card to say that this is my I conscientiously object to this, and therefore I can't be questioned, I can't be evaluated, I can't be judged. No, you can in fact have to, because you're bringing that into the public forum for a public debate, and for it to be morally just, the public has to be willing to engage in an honest deliberation with that person about their conscientious objections.
Let's take one more call from William in Kansas City, Missouri. William, good morning.
Hi there. Can you guys hear me okay?
We hear you.
Okay. I was bringing up the fact that you guys might like to talk about. I think about 6 months ago or so, they had an administrator in a hospital that was fired because they did an abortion at the hospital, and the abortion was a fallopian tube pregnancy. Do you guys remember that?
I don't actually remember that case. Where was that at?
I think it was up north in Wisconsin, but I'm not sure. But, you know, that's an interesting question. You know, do you let one person die or do you let both people die?
Okay. So often, and maybe this is often the case, Wayne and Clancy, where there's competing ethical interests.
Yeah, right, there is. With the fallopian tubes or ectopic pregnancies, as they're known, is when the pregnancy, instead of attaching in the uterus, it attaches in the fallopian tubes and outside of the uterus, and the fetus will then continue to develop. Those are almost always fatal, probably for both, potentially for both the mother and the child. There was one case where there was an ectopic pregnancy that was brought to term, but that's just an extreme rarity. Even the Catholic Church recognizes this issue as a principle of double effect that's used to help identify when one can act in a way that would violate one's conscience when one is performing an act that has foreseen yet unintended consequences. And so even ectopic pregnancies, the examples here are often defended even within Roman Catholicism as morally defensible, because what you're doing is eliminating a pregnancy that's terminating a pregnancy that's not going to likely result in a live birth, but it's a foreseen but unintended consequence. You're actually trying to save the mother's life, and you recognize that in so doing it's going to result in this undesired consequence.
That's Wayne Vaught, Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences here at UMKC. Clancy Martin is here too, Professor of Philosophy, Chair of the Department here at UMKC. There are ethics professors, and we'll continue in a moment talking about the ethics of following one's conscience as a professional in the workplace. We'll get into some questions about teachers who are teaching curriculum that they may or may not ethically or morally agree with. Maybe there are others that you know of too. Join the conversation. Call us at 816-235-2888. Email us at updatedat.kcur.org. You can even tweet at us. We're at KCUR UpToDate. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske, and you're listening to UpToDate on KCUR. And welcome back to UpToDate. I'm Brian Ellison, sitting in today for Steve Kraske, who is covering the president's visit to Joplin that you just heard about. He'll be back tomorrow, and he'll be joined by our techsperts, who will talk about the latest in technology news. If you missed Friday's round of Kansas City Categories with Elizabeth Alex, Chris Hernandez, and Nick Haynes, you will find that at kcur.org. We're talking today with our ethics professors about the ethics of following one's conscience in the workplace, the burdens that a pharmacist might carry about prescribing a drug that they morally find disagreeable, and others who face difficult decisions in the workplace. Clancy Martin is a professor of philosophy and at UMKC. Wayne Vaught, professor of bioethics and medicine and philosophy at UMKC. They are our ethics professors, and they're taking your calls at 816-235-2888. You can also email us at updatedat.kcur.org. We were talking about some specific cases where this comes up, and before the break we had a Facebook posting from Summer. She says, I work in the liquor industry, and we get so many folks in here with addictions. They get the shakes from alcohol withdrawal so that they can barely count their last dimes to buy a pint. I won't sell it to them if they're intoxicated, but if they're showing signs of withdrawal, It feels wrong to aid an alcoholic, like I'm contributing to their addiction. A tough call, Summer says. What do you guys think?
Well,
Clancy Martin?
The first thing I would say to Summer is that she is working in a liquor store, and that if she's not comfortable serving alcoholics, I agree, you shouldn't sell someone liquor if they're drunk, and I think that that is that's just true regardless of where liquor is being served. But if you're working in a liquor store, you may as well accustom yourself to the idea that you are going to be selling liquor to alcoholics.
Probably a few show up.
Yeah,
so it's another case of not putting yourself in a position to face this supposedly difficult ethical decision.
Exactly. Yeah. If this feels like a conflict of conscience to you, then I would say look for a different profession. You know, and there are lots of professions out there when you don't have to work with people with addictions. And I understand the feeling of you don't want to aid and abet somebody who is clearly suffering from an addiction or in, as some people talk about it in the literature, even a disease. On the other hand, this person has come in there of their own free will expecting that they will be sold this product, which they have the money to pay for and you are there to provide. And it does seem as though you have a professional responsibility in that situation, again, so long as they're not intoxicated, so long as they're not obviously in danger of doing someone else harm.
Right.
Of providing that service and or product to the person. You know.
Let's talk to David in Overland Park, who has some real life experience with us. David, good morning.
Good morning. First of all, I'd like to let you guys know the ethics professors are probably one of my top three or four favorite shows you guys have.
Thank you so much,
thank
David.
You. Great to hear.
You're our favorite caller, by the way.
Yeah.
So far,
our three favorite.
It actually makes sense, you know.
Tell us what your contribution is today, David.
Okay. Well, I am a heavy equipment operator, and back in like the early 2000s, just before the market crashed, I was driving a articulated dump truck. I thought I was going to be like, you know, resurfacing roads and that sort of thing. And it turned out I was actually helping them wholesale destroying the wilderness in Florida for new houses that we really needed. And I'm an environmentalist. So when I saw them tearing this stuff apart, it tore me apart. And they told me flat out, you know, this is your job. You either do it or you go home. And I see this current discussion as even being more important than that because, you know, I don't see where a pharmacist has a right to interrupt with what a doctor has already prescribed. If it's legal, then they don't have a right to tell me I can't have it if the doctor has told me it's something I'm supposed to have.
Well, that's a great example because you really bring out, and in the way you tell the story in your voice, you really bring out the moral tension there. Like on the one hand, you might really need the work and you don't want to quit your job. On the other hand, you suddenly find yourself in a position where you're being required, if you're going to keep the job, to do something that you find to be morally repugnant. So if you don't mind me asking, David, what did you do?
I was driving a 40-ton articulated dump truck for the
bulk. But what is the decision you made to resolve this tension?
Oh, I quit.
Good for you, man. Yeah, that's, I think you did the right thing.
You know,
well,
I think
my wife didn't think so.
You know, I mean, this is sort of a prime example of someone standing up for what you firmly believe in and paying a consequence, a price for that. And so this could be heralded, I think, you know, as an example of the morally exemplary behaviors, and it's one that I think many of us can relate to. The destruction of the environment, that there are certainly good causes to do that, but it becomes then, you know, a challenge is because if we have that agreement here, but we may not have the agreement on the next case or the next sort of scenario. And so one of the questions I think becomes, well, was the boss, was the company wrong by dismissing you or putting this demand on you that you can't do this? You know, I guess there could be another position, the anti-environmentally friendly groups that say, no, this is an economic boon, this is great for the community, you're misguided, and so this is why we're doing this. And someone else steps into that role and does it. And I think that part of that has to become up for the public debate. You would hope that, well, if there were enough environmentally conscious people, no one would be driving those trucks and the destruction ultimately wouldn't happen. And it's why this is sort of a fundamentally—
But you deal with the reality that someone else is going to take that job.
Someone else is going to actually take that job, and you're going to lose the potential revenues from it for standing up for something that you believe in. And I think that— that's a good thing and an appropriate thing. Now, just that transition to the pharmacist. Now, well, actually, one comment that he did make, and I'll just—it's not a—it's pharmacists are professionals in and of themselves, and they can refuse to dispense drugs for professional reasons. And this often happens: a physician will write a prescription for a drug, and the pharmacist may notice that it's contraindicated because of other drugs that the patient's taking, or have reasons to believe that this isn't in the patient's best interest, and can question that and not dispense based on professional grounds. The question is, should that apply then to moral grounds, to reasons of conscience? And so there are other defensible reasons why a pharmacist might refuse to dispense a particular pharmaceutical.
Thanks for that call, David. 816-235-2888 is the number to call. Dave in Shawnee. Good morning, Dave.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
I'm glad to hear the arguments for doing your duty in even in contradiction of your own personal convictions. If a cop were to walk into a biracial home to stop a fight and then turned around and walked away, said, let them sort it out, you know, let God sort it out, that would be absolutely repugnant to many, many people.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing as a pharmacist, you know, they walk in, they take a job, they know what the requirements are. They're not in a position to question what the doctor has ordered, except when it comes to contraindications and things like that, as you
right.
said, on a professional basis, not a moral basis.
Correct.
They don't have a moral standing to take in that job. My point is there's another thing happening here. There are people having so-called crisis of consciousness or conscience, taking these opportunities, these selected opportunities to make a social statement, to take the bully pulpit and use the situation to make a moral statement to the public, when in fact there are much more productive ways to do that and that don't take people's put people's lives in danger or change their situation in a way that brings harm to them potentially.
So, Dave, you're saying that the pharmacist who opposes the offering the RU486 prescription should be writing letters to their member of Congress and advocating,
or quit their job and find another pharmacy. You know, it's not their place to make policy, to make moral decisions as by point of policy, who I'm going to sell what to on a case-by-case basis based on their moral objections. That's not their job.
Wayne?
I think, yeah, there's a strong argument I think that can be made, and many do make it in this way. Another potential, again, this was getting don't want to seem like I'm being contrary, just trying to think about the dimensions of this, because I think it's really a fundamentally fascinating and deeply complex issue. But another way in which this could work out would be making accommodations for people, and we regularly do that in a workplace. And does the employer if I have someone who's working for me who has a moral objection to do X, but I have other employees who will do that, can I make an accommodation so that this person can still work and be gainfully employed, but they don't have to engage in the act that's morally offensive to them?
Right.
And quite frankly, the issues in which one would, as a pharmacist, find oneself in a moral quagmire are probably fairly small and limited. So if I'm running a large pharmacy and I have three or four pharmacists, I can get the patient this drug and this pharmacist doesn't have to provide it, then maybe it would be a little harsh to say, well, you just simply can't work here. But if it becomes that you're the only one and you're providing that, then it seems that the onus of obligation increases, I think, as the options for the patient decrease. And so in some way, the caller, I think, would be correct. In other ways, I think, as being morally respectable in a diverse, pluralistic society, we want to do everything we can to accommodate diversity and allow people to be gainfully employed as long as those issues can be accommodated. But sometimes they can't, and for good reasons. You know, we could imagine, I think a lot of people for religious reasons would accept or would even support this law that Brownback has signed into this legislation, Brownback signed into law. But they would probably be – those same groups might be morally offended if, imagine, say, a Jehovah's Witness is working in an ER and, you know, Jehovah's Witnesses don't themselves take blood transfusions for themselves. But imagine a scenario where this said person thinks that it's morally offensive for anyone to get a blood transfusion and refuses simply to provide that to a person in need because they find it morally offensive. I think there would be a lot of pushback to say, no, wait, you can't not provide blood to someone because they're going to die, even if, oh, no, I can't do something that I think is going to cause great harm to this person's immortal life and their soul. Mm. So I think that we would find, while many people do want to support religious objections to these types of things, that they only want to support it so far, and usually it's only so far as their particular religious traditions will allow them to go. Once they go into other people's religious traditions, I find it that people aren't as willing to support grounds of conscience.
Right. Your religious freedom is fine as long as it's
as long as it's the same as mine.
Right, exactly. Thanks for that question, Dave. You know, we've talked about a number of examples. Mostly here we've talked about the medical field, but there's sort of dozens of possible examples. One that comes up and has come up here in this area not too long ago is the question of evolution and more broadly the question of what teachers have to teach, in particular when it's in conflict with their own moral views or their beliefs of what is true or what is right. So take something like a science teacher in Kansas being required to teach evolution, or in Missouri being required to teach evolution when they themselves are troubled by that scientific concept. Clancy, what does the ethical situation there call on them to do?
Well, it's a question that the more you think about it again, the more interesting it becomes, because as a teacher, you have a duty not merely to sort of report the reigning dogma of the day, but actually to do your best to you have what we call in philosophy an epistemological duty, that is a duty about knowledge of the subject. An example of this that I like to use is during the Vietnam War, when students when almost all students were opposed to the war, a lot of professors around the country felt obligated, despite the fact that they themselves were also opposed to the war, a lot of them felt obligated to teach a dialogue called the Crito, which is one of Plato's early Socratic dialogues, in which Socrates has been placed in prison, and Crito comes to Socrates and says, Socrates, we've raised the money, we can get you out of prison. And Socrates says to Crito, well, I'll do it if it turns out that it's the right thing to do, by all means, Crito. But first, let's have a conversation about it, as Wayne keeps coming back to. Let's have a reasoned discourse about it and see whether it's the right thing. And if you can show me that it is indeed the right thing to do, then I'll do it. But if it turns out that it's the wrong thing to do, I'm not going to serve my own interest merely in order to get myself out of prison if I see that it's the wrong thing to do. And the reason that this dialogue was being taught all over the country by professors in universities was that after consideration of the fact that Socrates has gained everything that he has as a consequence of the laws of Athens, that he's freely chosen to live in Athens all of his life and only actually taken a couple of they weren't vacations. It was the two times he was in military service were the only times he left Athens, and that he's benefited from the laws in terms of his parents were married and so he couldn't have been born at all if it weren't for the laws, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. He comes to the conclusion that no, in this instance, even though it will mean the cost of my own life, I must do what the laws say, because I can't just change my mind now that it's inconvenient. And so why I find this interesting in the context of questions of conscience, right, independent of the Crito, which also speaks to precisely the issue we're talking about, is that a professor really is not necessarily got to teach what they think their students want to know, or even necessarily what an institution tells them to teach, but rather what they believe to be the truth. Right. Now, if they believe that evolution is false,
right. And there may be a difference between tenured professors at a university and a high school teacher.
Of
on
course,
the,
yeah, yeah. Know, on the... If they're teaching what they genuinely believe to be false. It does put them in kind of a funny situation, because you really should not be telling people things that you genuinely believe to be false and consider yourself to be a good teacher. On the other hand, there is such a thing as a curriculum, and you don't want to be following your own agenda when it comes to, you know, we don't want to be bringing our personal biases into the classroom either. We want to appeal to the kind of collective body of knowledge. Now, on the question of evolution, it seems to me to be fairly non-controversial, because it is so well established as accepted knowledge in our current society that evolution is true, that the teacher simply has to recognize, okay, I have a kind of personal belief here that stands in opposition to what I have to say. But
we may light up the phones again with that, but that's, yeah. but clearly there's an ethical dilemma that some teachers feel about.
But
it.
I think that an example speaking the other way is when this teacher was fired not too long ago for telling her elementary school students that there was no Santa Claus. And here, I guess she felt like...
I hope there's no children listening. He doesn't really mean that.
Yeah, I don't really
mean that.
They
have to fire you.
Hypothetically speaking.
Hypothetically, if there were no Santa Claus and taught these students. And presumably there, she felt like she had some appeal to her conscience about what the truth actually was. Whether or not it was appropriate for her to do that is another question.
Well, I hope we've resolved all of the questions that folks have, as often happens with these ethics shows. Sometimes more questions than answers. But we're grateful for it anyway. Wayne Vaught is dean of the College of Arts and Sciences, and Clancy Martin is professor and chair of philosophy, both at UMKC. Thanks again, both of you, for being here.
Thanks for having us again, Brian.
It's always a pleasure.
You will find details about them and all our guests and more information about our show at kcur.org. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We are at KCUR Up to Date. Tomorrow on the program, Steve Kraske will be back to talk with our techsperts about the latest in gadgets, information, and technology news. The show is produced by Steven Steigman, and we had help today from Kim Noble and Danny Alexander. I'm Brian Ellison, and you are up to date.